League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hi, everybody. I hope this finds you all safe and well as we plough on through this, what seems to be, never-ending lockdown. Hopefully, we'll get some news next week about, you know, at least a slight step towards things being relaxed safely, obviously. But in the meantime, though, we have all this amazing entertainment around us that we can dive into, which is a good thing, I think. I've been watching so many great films. The kids and I just watched the latest episode of WandaVision at lunchtime there. So, you know, I think if nothing else, it's providing us with a wonderful escape from real life at the minute. And I hope this podcast as well gives you a little bit of time to just lose yourself for, you know, for the time and the length of each episode. It is my absolute saving grace, and I have loved, and I'm very thankful and grateful that I've been able to keep this going throughout lockdown over the past year. So yeah, and I thank you guys for listening as well. Our latest guest on Soundtracking is American playwright and film and theatre director George C. Wolfe. What a legend he is. However, it's with certain sadness that we welcome George to the show, as his latest offering, the fantastic Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, also happens to be Chadwick Boseman's last performance before his passing. But what a performance it is. He and Viola Davis put on a virtuoso show as the eponymous blues singer and the trumpeter in her band. It's available to watch on Netflix now, so you can see for yourself why it landed numerous award nominations and has received widespread critical acclaim. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom was scored by Branford Marsalis, and it's with one of his cues that we begin, Chicago at Sunset. Now, just before we start, though, I wanted to say that we've been, and as I said at the beginning, very lucky with the sound for the 50-odd remote recordings that we've done during lockdown. But due to the vagaries of Zoom, George is a little distant during the interview, and we hope it doesn't spoil your enjoyment too much, as he really is a wonderfully engaging character. George, thank you so much for your time. I'm so excited to get to chat to you about film and music and this new film. It's a fantastic opportunity to dive into to how pictures and music and the relationship between those two is so important. Congratulations on Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. It is a beautifully rich, emotional and entertaining piece of work.
Oh, well, thank you.
I really would love to kind of find out where how this story came to you, how it was presented to you, this project.
Denzel Washington and I were going to be working on a Broadway show together. And it may have happened before then, because I don't really recall that. Or I think the first time he mentioned that he wanted me to direct Ma Rainey. So, because he had made a commitment to film all of August Wilson's work. And So while we were talking about doing this Eugene O'Neill play, he mentioned, you know, that he wanted me to do he wanted me to do Ma Rainey's. And so that's where I think the first time we talked, but I could be wrong about that.
I mean, there's so many wonderful stories, even just within that kind of, you know, short explanation. But for you, what was it about this, about Ma and this story and these characters that you saw the kind of visual interpretation of that story? Because the visuals in this are extraordinary.
Oh, well, thank you. I was drawn to the fact that Ma was acutely aware of her own talent, her own power. She was unapologetic about who she was. She wrote songs about being a lesbian. So there was this woman historically who was like this sort of ferocious, you know, commanding artist. And a lot of times artists have the reputations for being temperamental and crazy because of their insecurities or their damage or all of that. But here was somebody who wasn't temperamental. She was demanding because she knew her worth. And that I found really sort of thrilling. You know, in my family, there were a number of very strong women that I grew up with. So in some respects, this was my homage to them. and then I'm sort of, part of me is, I think, perpetually bound to the 1920s. Because it was such an extraordinary creative and political and cultural awakening time period. And so that was also a part of that. And because I've done a number of projects and I keep on being pulled back to the 20s. So all of that felt very exciting. And then I started to dig into the material. And then, you know, August has written this 10-play cycle. This is the only play that isn't set in Pittsburgh. It's the only play that doesn't focus in on family dynamics. It's the only one that has an LGBTQ character. It's the only one that's based on a famous person. So this oddness within the rest of the cycle,
yeah,
I found really fascinating and really interesting.
Does there come an added responsibility when it is you're telling someone's existing story, you know, in terms of that person, you know, was a real person?
Well, you know, I think there's a buffer between us, which is someone, i.e. August Wilson, has already done his version of that. So I'm doing his version of her. And then I'm researching as much as I can up specifically about her. And then I'm working with a brilliant, you know, artist in the form of Viola Davis, who's also going to dig in, you know, and I'm surrounded by, you know, incredibly skilled craftspeople who were, everybody worked so hard to get to the truth. The woman who made her horsehair wig, and she made it in putting horsehair strand by horsehair strand. I think she even got the horsehair from England. When she got it, it had manure and lice in it.
So, no.
Yes. So she had to boil it in hot water, which softened it. And then she put the wig, you know, horsehair strand by horsehair strand. And because Ma Rainey had a horsehair wig, because that's what they were making wigs out of at that time period, you know. So it was, so everybody was digging in to get at the truth, to get at the truth, to get at the truth. The actors, yeah. But, you know, the person making the wig, the person doing the makeup, you know what I mean? Everybody was so invested in getting at the thing.
Yeah. Did you know much about Ma before you know, you started talking about this project? Were you how aware were you of her story?
I was sort of generally aware. I knew that she was an out lesbian. I knew some of her songs. I knew that she traveled around. She had tent shows and a number of facts like that. What I did not know is that she owned two theaters in Georgia. And I was working and doing research. I got a list of her touring schedule for 1926. And it had like 30 stops on it. So this woman, wow, and it was most throughout the South. You know, and so we all have our connotations of what the Southern United States was like in the 20s with lynchings and the Jim Crow laws.
Yeah.
She built a showbiz empire. And I'm from the South. I'm not, you know, I'm not from Georgia. I'm from Kentucky. But, you know, because of segregation, people had to create their own structures. I remember at one point I drove my father back to his hometown. And we were driving through the town. It's a tiny little town. And he and his sister were going, you know, and they were both probably in their 70s. And they, as we were driving around, she was going, that's where the ballroom was. And that's where Dr. So-and-so's office was. And that's where the dentist's office was. And she was pointing to these empty lots, but she was naming all of these Black businesses. So because, you know, because segregation, you know, the laws were saying, get the hell away from us. And so all these Black people built up a community and built up a support system, built up structures, and were supporting each other and supporting their community. And Ma was doing the exact same thing. So I found all of that really thrilling and inspiring. And I know all sorts of stories, but the more I dug into her, the more I realized, oh, she's you know, she was a showbiz entrepreneur.
Yeah, in the 20s as well, in terms of how she was able to position herself there as a Black woman is absolutely extraordinary.
It was extraordinary and not extraordinary.
Yeah.
Because people were doing it, you know.
Yeah.
The first woman millionaire, I think that millionaire was this woman named Madam C.J. Walker, who invented this, you know, the straightening comb and stuff that you did for your hair. And she, and her energy was not just the invention, but then training young Black women to then go out and sell her products all in North and South America. So it was about entrepreneurship and being self-sufficient and being powerful and being in command of your existence. So it was really, so that energy that Ma had, it was an energy that was cursing throughout the Black community at the time, because, you know, every generation believes they're going to shatter all the problems. And then they come into opposition, and then the next generation comes along and says, no, I'm going to shatter all the problems. And, you know, and that's how progress is made.
Yeah. I feel like this could almost have been the first of a whole collection of films about Ma, just in terms of how rich her story is.
Absolutely.
And, you know, how rich her life is. And Viola's performance it's full to the brim of emotion and characterization. It's so fantastic to watch.
Oh, great. Well, I totally agree. Yeah, unfortunately, there's, you know, the film is set in 1927, and after 1928, she never recorded again, you know.
Shame.
So it is toward the end of her career. And the thing which was really interesting, when I was in post, I found out, because I went digging, and my assistant went digging, there are a total of 7 pictures of her in existence on the planet.
7?
Total.
Oh, my God.
Unless there's some hidden in somebody's basement or attic, 7.
Yeah, that's them. That's the album.
That's it.
Wow. Would Viola kind of go from them? Because, I want to get onto music in a second, because obviously the music in this is brilliant, and it's got so many jobs and purposes within the film as well, but with that, where did Viola start with regards to that performance of Mad, you know? Because, you know, we know that Viola Davis is one of the world's greatest performers, but this is almost another, you know, she just keeps surprising us with, you know, that we don't know she can do it, we know she can do it, but just surprises us with the extent of these performances that she brings up time and time again. And this is another great example of that.
And so she did a lot of research. She read, you know, there's a finite amount of information, you know, about Ma. There's X number of interviews where people talk about Ma and talk about what kind of performer she was and what kind of human being she was. So she dug into all of that. One of the early conversations that she and I had via internet was, she was, you know, one of the things that she was talked about was the wear and tear of having to perpetually fight to get what you deserve. And that was the thing that she spoke about. And also she spoke about that that you know, she taught Bessie Smith. Her and Bessie Smith were, by all accounts, lovers, although allegedly I was told to say, as opposed to saying, that they were lovers. you know, but that by this time in her career, Bessie had usurped her. Bessie was a more popular figure. Mm. You know, Bessie did the East Coast tour. So she would travel along the East Coast, ending up in New Jersey and in New York. So white intellectuals, you know, Carl Van Vechten had a party, you know, at his house, in which Gershwin and all the leading cultural figures were there. And Bessie got, this is fabulous story, where Bessie got drunk and ended up punching out someone. But she was surrounded by leading cultural figures of the day, white cultural figures. So they knew about her. I'm completely correct in this. I don't think she ever journeyed to New York. I don't think she was a part of the Harlem landscape. So therefore, you know, there were articles in Vanity Fair about Bessie Smith. There were none about Ma Rainey. And also people considered her, she was considered not attractive. She didn't have glamour the way someone like Bessie Smith had glamour. So, you know, all of that.
Yeah, all of that. When it came to, you know, because these are your cast is extraordinary, and the way that they have to perform as musical performers and the preparation that goes into that, you know, Viola extraordinary. We'll talk about Chadwick's performance in a second as well. But what's the prep that, I mean, do you speak to them in advance in terms of how they prepare for that side of it, in terms of, you know, they're going to be performing within a performance almost in a way?
Well, you know, they were informed that they were going to have to play music and play instruments. They didn't necessarily have to play them, but they needed to behave and act as if they were in command of them, because they are a very seasoned band. So they were given tutors to work with. Bradford Marticellis said that Michael Potts, who played Slow Drag, showed up and he was sort of perfect. So he didn't have to bother, like he had mastered it. And but they all had tutors. Coleman, who plays Cutler, and Glenn Turman, who plays Toledo.
Toledo, you know, yeah.
And Chadwick, when one of our early conversations that he and I had, he wanted the exact fingering for every single song. And I told Bradford, and he went, really? I said, yes. So he had someone send him fingering for every single song, and Chadwick mastered the fingering for every single song. You know, his pitch wasn't great. I played trumpet badly for 8 years, but he mastered it, and they just worked really, really very hard, and they became a band in their own way. Mm.
Hello, Central, give me 609. What it takes to get it in these hips of mine. Oh, you hear me talking to ya. I don't bite my tongue. You wanna be my man, you better bring it with you when you come. You wanna be my man, bring it with you when you come.
I mean, the way that his instrument's almost like a, you know, the way he caresses that instrument as he's walking through scenes and having conversations, it's, you know, it's constantly connected to him. It's like a child. It's like it's like an extra limb. It's just, it's 100%. Part of his being.
And that's the way he was. And that's the way he was on set. That's the way he was on set. When between takes, he'd have that horn out. He'd be holding it. He'd be, you know, he'd have the mouthpiece up to his mouth. It was, he formed a very, very, very intimate relationship with it as well. So it was built into his performance, absolutely.
Way down south in Alabama, I got a friend they call Dancing Sam. Who's crazy about all the latest dances? Black bottom stomps and the new. swelled affair. Soon as the boys found out that I was there, they said, come on, ma, let's go to the cabaret. When I got there, they began to say, I want to see the dancing, call the black bottom. I want to learn that dance. Want to see the dance you call your big black bottom. It put you in a trance. All the boys in the neighborhood, they say, yo, black bottom is really good. Come on and show me your black bottom. I want.
You mentioned Branford Marsalis, who's your, composer and musical maestro on this film, you know, and part of a massive musical family as well. What's that conversation that you have, or that decision making process on who you're going to work with when it comes to music, and particularly with this film? There was a certain requirement in terms of, it wasn't just a case of creating score for the film as well. There was a lot more needed and required for the music side of
it. Well, this is the second film that Branford and I did together. We did a film called Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks for HBO. And so that was the first time we had worked together. We knew each other, I think, around the time when I first moved to New York. He would first move to New York. So we were traveling in different circles, but knew of each other. And then, but Henrietta Lacks was the first time we worked together, and we had a great collaboration and we got along really well. And he's like this incredible, he's a brilliant musician, a brilliant composer, an astonishing musicologist, and a historian. So, I mean, recently I was considering doing a project, that I ended up not doing. But, when I was thinking about it, I called up Branford and I said, I'm thinking about doing this thing that sort of, it's blues based, what is the difference between Georgia and what was going on in Mississippi and what was going on? And I just asked him these general questions, and like literally sort of 15 minutes later, he sent me like 30 files of,
wow.
This is that. And so he's just, and then I was on the phone with him, and he was explaining what was going on with this and this. And, so he's like, it's just there. It isn't history to him. It's intimate.
Kind of the score has got to, it's got to have a beautiful marriage with the performances that are happening within.
Yeah.
It can't jolt. It's got to have fluidity with it and
Absolutely.
Stuff. And that's, was that a case of then you deciding on the final, what the final score cues would be, and shooting those performances and in an edit, and then Branford seeing what would work texturally, I guess, or had you already kind of made those decisions on the music and the tone and the themes and things like that as well?
Before I started filming?
Yeah.
Not really. You know, the focus was primarily making sure that the performances, that the musical performances or the look of the musical performances were as flawless as they could be. And then once I started editing, when I started editing and shaping and putting it together, that's when he and I started talking. We had preliminary conversations about finding Levy's sound. What would his sound be? Because, you know, you have a full range of music that's going on. You have Jelly Roll Morton is in Chicago at the exact same time that Ma Rainey. And simultaneously, you have Duke Ellington performing at the Cotton Club, and that level of sophistication and harmonics and urban sound. And so all of these incredibly brilliant musicians, and then you have, you know, the white musicians who are finding themselves inside the rhythm of the rhythms of jazz and blues, and in some cases, like Paul Whiteman, they're sanitizing it. You know, there was this dynamic that was going on about this music, which was giving America its first sense of identity that was not so heavily dominated by a European aesthetic. And so that's one of the things that I think is so really interesting and fascinating to me about the 20s. And so just talking about all of that with Branford and trying to find that Chicago sound versus all these guys are also from the South. So that therefore, when they start telling stories, what is that music? And so just having this vast vocabulary that was available to us from the 20s, and also mining that vocabulary. Very early on in the editing process, I discovered this drummer named Baby Dodds, who was this 20s jazz drummer, and which is so interesting because I was so startled to find it, because, you know, it's very rare, because then there are jazz drummers from the 30s and the 40s galore, but finding someone from the 20s who was capturing that sound, and so that was thrilled. I found that thrilling. And then, of course, when I talked to Branford about it, he knew everything about that Baby Dodds. it was just digging in and exploring and talking with him and doing my own digging to try to put those rhythms inside of my body as well. So that therefore it was informing my editing, so that those rhythms were informing in some respects how I was editing the scenes, even though the score was to come later. Thank you.
George, it feels like there's a documentary almost in the making of this film in terms of the, you know, what you discovered along the way, because this, it feels like a beautiful kind of, you know, for us as film and music fans, well, there's so much in the film, like these layers that you talk about, and how the music for me, I really sort of saw was the... It was the way of expression, you know. It was the only way of expression, you know, and being able to be very true, the place and the thing that they could be the truest to themselves with.
It's so very interesting, because one of the things that I love about the blues is, you know, there were X number of black newspapers who were chronicling, you know, the black experience in this country. But it wasn't in history books, and it was occasionally, but rarely, in mainstream white newspapers. So the blues became the place where history was stored. You know, there would be blues songs about the flood that passed through. There would be blues songs about the Titanic and the Lusitania. Were chronicling the world in their music. So a lot of times when you go back and you dig into blues lyrics, you find the history of the time. When I did the show about Jelly Roll Morton, and I found this song, I'm going to get it wrong, but it was like 219 took my baby away, 219 took my baby away, 807 going to bring him back someday. They're talking about trains. The names of planes. There's so much history and story and detail in that, where did that person go on that train, and the train that's going to bring him back, where is that coming from? There's so much truth embedded in blues lyrics, and that's why I love them so much.
219 done took my baby away. Two-nineteen took my babe away. Two-seventeen, bring her back someday.
I could talk to you for hours, sir. You're just so, so wonderful. And I would be great to talk in the future at some point as well, just about your kind of, you know, your work in the theatre and how that, you know, how that differs in terms of working for film or TV as well, and particularly when it comes to music, if it's a different approach, if it's a different thought process as well. But I can't thank you enough for Ma Rainey. It's just a wonderful, you know, on the surface level, it's a beautiful, entertaining film to watch, but there is so much bedded within it as well that reveals itself when you luxuriate in it.
It's
so great to chat to you, and thank you so much for your time, George. Thank you. From the score to Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, that's L Train by Branford Marsalis, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with George C. Wolfe. My huge thanks to George for taking the time to talk to me. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is available to watch on Netflix now and is worth it for so many things, including that fantastic music, not to mention Viola and Chadwick's performances. Head to edithbowman.com to catch up with all of our previous episodes. My website is also the place to subscribe to the pod and find links to Spotify playlists for every show, in which we put the songs we feature in the order they appear so that you can listen to them in full. A lovely way to celebrate the music for each episode, so please do go and have a listen to that too. Also, if you aren't already, please follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And do keep telling everyone you know about us if you like what you hear. I also put together a regular little YouTube show after some technical problems. The latest is out now with Sophia Coppola, Jenna Coleman and Tessa Thompson. So please head over to YouTube and just search for Soundtracking with Edith Bowman. We'll be back next week with more conversation around film and music. In the meantime, stay safe, look after each other, and I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.